It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we hit the trails for a look at cross-country skiing here in Wisconsin.
First, 2015 was a challenging year for Governor Scott Walker's relationship with the state. He spent most of the year running for president and came away with $1 million of debt. And his job approval rating dropped more than 10 points to an all-time low of 37%.
Since he dropped out of the presidential race in late September, he refocused his attention on Wisconsin, according to our next guest reporting. Matt DeFore joins us now. He's a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Rob, thanks for having me on again.
Well, it seems so long ago, Matt, but take us back to 2015. What evidence do we have, and what was the perception that Governor Walker had lost touch with the state?
Well, yeah, I mean, a year ago, we were just coming off of Governor Walker's breakout performance at the Iowa Freedom Summit in Des Moines. And from there, he rose in the national presidential polls. He was an all-star traveling around the country. And he was at the same time wrangling with a very difficult budget situation in Wisconsin. And I think those two things combined certainly were factors in his approval rating, his job approval rating in the state taking a big hit. You know, there were obviously a lot of things that were going on last year, but, you know, in polls taken in the fall and into January, his approval rating had fallen about 10 points from where it was right before he won re-election in fall 2014.
And talk about the scope of that drop. You had a map, a graphic on there. Almost everywhere in the state saw some or a substantial drop in approval.
Right. I think the most stark places are in the northern parts of the state. If you look at the map we had in a paper on Sunday, the Fox Valleys, I think there was about a 16-point drop. And in the northern parts of the state, which includes sort of if you just think of everything north of Wausau, I guess, it was more than 20 points that he's dropped. And so he certainly seems to have a lot of work cut out for him in just reconnecting with those voters. And that's, I think, what we've seen him trying to do over the last 4 months.
Well, talking about what's at stake here, low approvals don't matter unless the governor runs for office again, runs for a third term. He's been starting to hint at that, hasn't he?
Well, that's right. And he, in the last, I think, the end of last year, was starting to suggest that he might run for a third term, that he might he believes he has some unfinished business. He hasn't said that he will, though, and I think we'll know a lot more after the presidential election shakes out, and we'll see what happens with the next state budget and with the state economy. But he's got a lot of skeptical people out there for sure. I think in the latest Marquette poll, 61% of people said they would not like to see him run for a third term. So we'll see if that number changes as he reconnects with people in the state.
You found an interesting person to talk to, a former Republican governor who had a failed presidential bid himself, Tommy Thompson. What was his advice for Governor Walker?
Right, well, Tommy, he didn't get very far running for president back in 2008, but he did run for governor a third and fourth time. And so he's got experience having won the third term for governor, at least. And he doesn't sound too high on the governor's chances. To put the governor's numbers in perspective, he's at 38% in his job approval rating. You know, when Scott McCallum ran for governor in 2002, this is after Tommy became Health and Human Services Secretary, and his approval rating was at 40% heading into that 2002 election against Jim Doyle. So, you know, that's a number that, 38%, I think, is just from a historical perspective pretty low. So the Governor Thompson suggested he basically said he would not advise Governor Walker to run for a third term. He thinks the hurdles are too high.
Talking to Matt DeFore from the Wisconsin State Journal about Governor Walker, his relationship to Wisconsin, and his efforts to rekindle that relationship. And let's move to that now, Matt. Governor Walker has been taking his act on the road. What's he been doing?
Well, right after he got out of the presidential election back in September, one of the first things he announced was a Working for Wisconsin tour. And I think that title had sort of a double entendre in its conception. You know, he's touting how his initiatives and policies have been working for Wisconsin. But I think there's a sort of a subtle reminder there that he's still working for Wisconsin as well, even though he had spent the previous 9 months, on the national campaign trail. And so that was one of his first initiatives in terms of reconnecting. He also announced a 2020 Vision, a project in which he is holding a series of invitation-only meetings with groups of about 30 or so residents of the state. These are in various places around the state. He's been to a number of them already, starting in December, and he's continuing. He hopes to do a couple every week, and so that seems to be a way that he's trying to find out more about what people in the state think about how things are going. I think he's asking them what's good about the state and how things could become better.
Yeah, talk us through how these meetings, these 2020 vision meetings, go. This is not politician stands up and talks and then leaves.
Yeah, well, I thought it was kind of interesting talking to people who attended these meetings, that the governor is attending these in jeans and a button-down shirt, very casual. He's not having some staff member go up and, take notes. He's actually up there leading, at the head of the classroom kind of thing, with a dry erase marker and writing the responses to these questions on the board. And his office, when we asked about these meetings, they provided sort of a summary of the notes from the meeting. I think they're grappling with the understanding that if you have a big, public forum where you invite everybody who wants to come, that you might have sort of an unwieldy audience. But, there's a lot of people, I think, who are also very critical and skeptical about having an invitation only, because then do you sort of skew the results? Do you sort of not only pick people that you want to be there, but even among the people who might be critics, is their perception of you changed in some way because you were giving them an invitation to some exclusive event? So it's kind of a difficult situation, but there's different philosophies about what's the best way to gather this information. So
I kind of wonder who's still at play when it comes to forming opinions on Governor Walker. I think a lot of people, like him or not, they know if they like him or not. They either are backing him and supporting him, or from Act 10 or some point onward decided they didn't like him. Are there that many people still who might be switching their minds back and forth?
Yeah, I think the data we've seen from the Marquette poll certainly shows that the governor's job approval rating has declined among, as Charles Franklin, the director of the poll, said, it's widespread. But if you look at some of the groups, not only is it geographic, but politically, those who lean Republican, so those who say when you ask them in a poll, are you a Democrat, a Republican, or independent, and they say they're an independent, and then you say, well, do you lean Democrat or do you lean Republican? Those who are independents who lean Republican, their support for the governor has declined, I think about 23 points, down from about 83% to 60%. And so that's a significant drop among independents. Those who, when you ask that question, they say, I don't lean either way. I'm a definite independent. They also, their support's dropped about 19 points from, I think, in the upper 30s or lower 40s down to the lower 20s. So, I mean, it's, he's definitely got work to do with the folks who I think may be more of the deciders in these elections when they don't just, they're not partisans on the far right or far left. They are more moderate and look at, I think they have more open mind about the different candidates coming across. And so they're the ones I think he has the most work to do with.
So when do you think the governor might see his work, these 2020 vision meetings, the working for Wisconsin tour, paying off, if at all? Do you think that maybe in the next Marquette poll, in the next month or two, we might start to see a difference?
I mean, we'll certainly be paying attention. I don't know how soon it will happen. I think a lot of the Republican strategists I spoke with would give it a little bit longer, only because we're right now in the midst of a presidential election cycle. No one's really paying attention to the gubernatorial issues as much. And so, when we get closer to an actual election cycle, when, the governor's doing advertising or, so if he decides to run in 2018, you may not see it until his people are actually out there, banging the drum saying, hey, this is all the good stuff the governor's doing. But that, he's doing it right now in very small groups. He's not doing it in large scale type campaign here to persuade people that he's doing a good job. So it could take time.
And 2 years in politics to the next election, 2 years is a long time as we wrap up, Matt.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, the governor, he's been going nonstop since he was elected for the first time in 2010. So I mean, it's anyone's guess how much longer it's going to take, but he's finally getting a chance to catch his breath, and I think he's trying to reconnect on it with that in mind.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rod, thanks for having me again.
That's Matt DeFore. He's a state capitol reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. He was with us to talk about how Governor Scott Walker is reacting to lower polling numbers, approval numbers in the state after his presidential run, and trying to rekindle his relationship with voters here in Wisconsin. When Pam Furderbar moved into a home near a ski hill at age 10, her parents thought that skiing just might be her sport. It didn't quite work out.
When I lived in Los Angeles, winter preparedness meant turning on a pool heater. Here in Wisconsin, come Halloween, my pops puts a shovel, blankets, snowmobile suit, heavy rubber boots, and a roll of duct tape into the back of his Suburban. He is either the most winterized person in the Midwest or a conscientious serial killer. When I was 12 years old, we moved into the first home we owned in Delafield, at the top of a ski hill called Little Swiss Vale. My folks discussed the possibility that skiing might be my sport. Thanks to my grandma's succulent Czech butter cookies, I lacked the body for ballet, swimming, tennis, roller, or ice skating. We already had a closet crammed with pink tulle, a tennis racket, skates, and my swim fins, so it seemed prudent to rent ski equipment. When I arrived for my lesson, I was wearing 4 pair of long underwear, 3 sweaters, 5 pairs of socks, and a snowsuit that barely zipped due to the extra layers and grandma's butter cookies. A busload of children from the Holy Assumption Blind School disembarked in the parking lot and were escorted to the rental hut where they were fitted for boots, skis, and poles. My lesson consisted of sidestepping partway up the bunny hill, then snowplowing a few feet to the bottom. I watched other kids take the tow rope to the top, pivot, and shoosh, shoosh, shoosh elegantly down the hill. I wanted that. I trudged to the tow rope, clutched the rough hemp between my woolly mitts, and was jerked a few feet up the hill, ultimately unable to hang on thanks to a lack of upper body strength. The mittens were torn off my hands. Stuck to the coarse fibers, they passed through an enormous cog at the top of the hill before returning to the start, where my dad plucked them off the rope. I watched the blind children take their lessons on the bunny hill while my dad went to the Suburban for a roll of duct tape, which he used to secure the mittens to my wrists. My dad reasoned the plan would work as long as my arms weren't ripped from their sockets. Taped up, I gripped the cable tightly and hung on for dear life. About 2/3 of the way up, I realized my mitts were stuck to the hemp. I watched helplessly as the huge cog at the top chomped the rope in its giant teeth, pulling me toward its giant maw. I furiously wiggled my hands, trying to free them from the mittens, but thanks to the duct tape, they were snug around my wrists. Only a few feet from the grinding colossus, I finally jerked my hands out of the mittens. Time stood still, as did I. For a nanosecond, then I began to slide backwards. Quickly gaining speed and momentum, I hurtled down the hill, picking off blind children who had taken the tow rope behind me. They never saw me coming. One by one, down they went. At the bottom of the hill, my dad yanked my feet out of the ski boots while they were still clamped to the skis. I ran to the truck in my socks while my dad hurled the skis, boots, and poles into the rental hut. We sped off as a team of instructors, teachers, and bystanders rushed to help the children scattered in the snow. At dinner that night, it was decided I should try piano lessons.
Pam Furderbar is the author of Feng Shui and Charlotte Nightingale. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Cross-country skiing is a popular winter pastime in Wisconsin. Joining us to talk about cross-country skiing in our state is Chad McGrath. He's the author of several cross-country skiing guides, including Great Cross-Country Ski Trails, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and Ontario. Chad, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, thanks.
Well, Chad, what initially drew you to cross-country skiing?
I think the quiet, and first time I ever skied was at night on the Ridges Golf Course in Wisconsin Rapids, and it was a night ski with a couple friends, and I had never been before, and I knew within half an hour that I was hooked. It was just kind of a magical feeling to glide along, and the darkness made it even cooler.
And the downhill skiing, people know the adrenaline rush, the thrill of that. Cross-country skiing seems like it has a quieter appeal.
Well, yes. The speed doesn't have to be there if you don't want it to be. And there's obviously more physical exertion involved in most cross-country skiing. You have to propel yourself up the same hill that you get to come down. But going down those hills, if you pick the right place and if you want some thrills, you can have some great downhill ski fun on Nordic skis.
How would you say Wisconsin stacks up when it comes to cross-country skiing?
Oh, I think it's one of the best in the country. There's some nice places out east, Vermont and such. And there's some out west also in the Rockies. The problem with the Rockies is the relief is so great that a lot of times you have to climb for half an hour before you get to come down. And so it's a different kind of skiing. It's still nice, but it's different. I've skied in Alaska and I've had the same experience where you may spend 20 minutes climbing, gradual incline, and then you spend 5 minutes going down a gradual incline. So Wisconsin has a terrific amount of different terrain, sharper and faster hills, not as many long gradual hills.
What are some of your favorite places to ski here in Wisconsin?
Well, I was thinking, I don't know the actual number anymore of ski trails in Wisconsin. If one would include trails that are not groomed, it's certainly well over 100, maybe over 200. If you include only groomed trails, meaning trails that someone has taken a motorized vehicle, snowmobile, or something fancier, and gone out and set or at least rolled a flat track in the snow, then probably 150 trails in Wisconsin. So there's quite a number of places to go. The DNR does a nice job of grooming a number of trails in the north and central Wisconsin. And then there are some counties like Marathon County and Brown County have trail systems that they maintain along with the local ski clubs. And then there are a couple of full service, if you will, ski centers, Monaco Winter Park, and then one just over the border in Michigan, Active Backwood Retreats, ABR, who have 70 to 80 kilometers of trail that they groom with heavy machines and are immaculately taken care of and are great places to go ski.
Right, and you mentioned the ridges. Do you have a favorite spot where you go when you really want to have the ultimate cross-country skiing experience?
Well, I think I probably would resort to either Winter Park or ABR because there's a lot of trail and they're nicely taken care of. But in terms of just some of the DNR trails that go through public land that are very pleasant, there's one in near Woodruff called Madeline Trail, which is a diagonal stride only as opposed to a skating and striding trail. So a diagonal stride just means that it has the traditional two tracks that you put your skis in and cruise down the trail in. And so Madeline in Woodruff is a very pleasant, nice diagonal stride trail. And then I have to mention the Berkey Trail up in Hayward and Sawyer County, Bayfield and Sawyer County. Excellent, fun, difficult, hilly trail system. There's many, many kilometers of trail, either the Berkey Trail or trails at both ends that are associated with it. They're well maintained and a lot of fun to ski.
How has the snow been this year?
Well, if north of Highway 8, it's been pretty good. We've had early snow. I was skiing in October, had to quit for a while, and then in early November we got 15 inches of snow. I live up in Iron County. So we've had enough snow. It hasn't really snowed here more than an inch or two in a month, but the snow has maintained and it's you can go out and ski. If you're south of Highway 8, south of Highway 29, I know it hasn't been that good. I skied a little bit down there, but not much. So nothing like last year. Last year was almost too much snow. It was hard to groom. It was hard to pack. And if you went out without if you went out on a trail that wasn't trodden and hadn't been groomed, you know, you were skiing in snow up to your knees up here and a lot of places in the state, which can still be fun. But if you're going to do that, you might as well put on snowshoes and go for a walk.
All right, Chad, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
That was Chad McGrath. He's the author of several cross-country skiing guides, including Great Cross-Country Ski Trails, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and Ontario.
I have cross-country skied in zero of those places. That's one of those things is like, I ought to do it sometimes, but I never pull it together.
You live in Wisconsin.
I know, right?
It might behoove you to
and
give
I
it
used
a try.
To live in Michigan.
Yeah.
All good skiing places. You've done it.
Yes, I did a lot when I was younger, and I have skis, but I haven't used them the last couple of winters. But yeah, I highly recommend go rent a pair of skis and just try it. Even you, Rob, could do this.
Even I, by limited coordination
even you.
And endurance, could do this. Give it a try. Registering for Selective Service has been something of a rite of passage for young men who are citizens of the United States. A federal requirement, registering has meant being on record in the case of a military draft. To ensure compliance, failure to register can have significant consequences like not being eligible for some forms of federal financial aid and being disqualified for federal employment.
But now that women have been deemed eligible for all combat positions in the military, there have been calls for young women to have to register as well. Some top military leaders support that change, and at the most recent GOP debate, presidential candidates like Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, and Marco Rubio all supported the idea.
Joining us now to discuss the proposal is Philip Ewing. He's National Security Editor for NPR, previously Politico's Pentagon correspondent and senior defense reporter at Politico Pro. Philip, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this issue of women registering for Selective Service, is this something that's come up a lot in the past, or is this kind of a big new concept?
It's relatively new because in the past few months, the Defense Department, for the first time, has authorized women to be eligible for all combat jobs across the military. And so with the lowering of that barrier, now becomes more of a political question for members of Congress about, with those jobs open, does that mean women should have to register the way young men do, as you described earlier?
Now, the main purpose of Selective Service, as we mentioned, is to have us ready for a draft. We need lots of soldiers. We need to conscript people quickly. That doesn't seem like something that's probably going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, that's right.
Correct.
That's a lot of this is very theoretical and very political.
And 1973 was the last time we had a draft in effect. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It went away altogether until 1979. And then President Jimmy Carter, in response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, in an attempt to show the resolve of the United States to resist Soviet expansion, called for the draft to be reauthorized. But again, it's theoretical. Congress would have to pass a law declaring a war or some kind of national crisis, and then actually additional laws most likely to restore the draft to effect.
So is this in part a symbolic measure to back up to support the idea of opening all military roles to women?
Yeah, that's right. Advocates for requiring young women to register as part of the Selective Service say that if they are going to enjoy the same kind of opportunities that men long have in terms of frontline infantry units, special operations units, and other previously closed jobs in the military, women should also have the obligation that young men do to register for the draft. There are a couple of bills in Congress that would effectively put that into law, and there are also lawsuits in the federal courts that are making the way through the system now that would also achieve that same effect. But because the U.S. isn't in a major crisis, and because this issue is very fraught politically, the draft itself is very unpopular. I'm not sure how much actual action we may see by members of Congress other than some of these informational hearings that they like to have where they gather opinions from people on the subject.
And, Philip, as I understand it, there are a couple legal cases making their way through the court system right now. This could be something that happens in the courts before it happens in Congress?
Yes, that's correct. The Defense Department and the White House, the Obama administration, have not taken public positions on this. They've said the issue should be studied. They want to review what this would mean in terms of administration and costs and things like that. But they have not actually gone out there. A few military leaders have. The Chief of the Army, General Mark Milley, the Chief of the Marine Corps, General Bob Neller, they've both said their personal view is women should register for the draft. But there's no big push by the administration right now to make that happen anytime soon.
We're talking with Philip Ewing. He's a national security editor for NPR, looking at women in the military and women in civilian life, whether they should have to sign up for selective service, meaning that they could be part of a draft if one were to happen. Unlikely, it looks like right now, our guest says. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. In some ways, this draft issue, the selective service issue, is a sidebar to this bigger move toward an expanded role for women in the military. What's been driving that shift in policy toward women in the military, Philip?
Well, one thing has been President Barack Obama. He has lowered a lot of historic barriers to open service in the military services. First, it was for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people who now can serve openly. Then it was for women into these frontline combat jobs. And over the president's administration, he has sought to make as many opportunities open to people as possible. And so a lot of this is political messaging. It's a way for, in his case, Democrats to signal their support for inclusion, for equal opportunity. And in turn, Republicans and conservatives, in some cases, have signaled their opposition. You mentioned in your intro the GOP debate that took place the other day. Texas Senator Ted Cruz, the Republican frontrunner, said he opposes drafting women. He said he didn't want to get into a whole world of political correctness and that he thought that these requirements should remain closed to women, at least for the time being.
And what's been the response from military leaders, maybe current and former, because former military leaders can speak a little more freely, I think. Are people at the top embracing this idea, or has there been some reluctance?
Well, we don't know what the Navy and the Air Force leadership thinks of this idea.
The selective service part in particular.
Correct. They've been more cautious in terms of talking about this because the Defense Department and the Obama administration have not taken a public position. We do know that General Neller, the head of the Marine Corps, told the Congress that because women are now going to be admitted to any role for which they can qualify in terms of the screening, the physical requirements, and so forth, that in his view, that should make them eligible for the draft as well. And I expect that would become a common position among advocates, given that theoretically every job in the armed forces now could be open to both men and women.
And there was some pushback, I believe, from Marine Corps leadership about the idea of having women in combat roles. How did that play out?
That's right. So before the decision by the Pentagon to open all these roles, the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Carter, asked for input from the service chiefs about how this policy could be implemented. And the Marine Corps did a study of mixed men and women units in infantry context in California, and it found, per its own study, that they weren't as efficient as all-male infantry units, which has, you know, been the longstanding norm in the Marine Corps. And so their position inside the Pentagon was, we oppose admitting women to these roles. Carter took that input in and ultimately overruled it, deciding that all these jobs would be open after all. And, you know, he's the boss and the president stands behind him. So the Marine Corps is in a position where it's going to execute those orders and implement this new policy despite its previous opposition.
Is there a thought that depending on who the next president is, that we could see a step back from that? Say, if that president is Ted Cruz, would he be able to change that policy after Inauguration Day?
That's a great question, and that's one of the things that he, in his case, has used to signal to conservatives where he is culturally. This is all about symbolism and politics. These are very theoretical questions because the draft is very unlikely and very unpopular, as we were discussing earlier. However, it allows him to say to Republicans and conservatives, here's my worldview, here's where I come down on this hot-button question, and if you agree with me, then you should support me.
On a practical level, this is a new thing, the women in combat roles part, not the selective service part. How is the military doing on implementing this? What's the time span? What has to happen?
Well, in the case of the Army and the Marine Corps, it could be months or years before there are very many women in these infantry, tank, artillery, and other units. There weren't any before, and the way it works in the military services is there's a huge pipeline of recruiting and training people before you can actually field them into these units. And so now that these opportunities are open, the Army and the Marine Corps have to go elsewhere in the service and find women who want to move over into those jobs. They'll start with senior enlisted leaders, people like sergeants, and officers like lieutenants and captains to put them into place and have there be leaders for young women who are junior enlisted or junior officers just coming in for the first time to have a mentor or someone with whom they can identify in those units. That's the technique the Navy used, for example, when it began fielding women aboard warships and most recently aboard nuclear submarines. And the Air Force did a similar thing when women began to take combat jobs as fighter pilots. So the process has been used before. The new thing is doing it in the context of infantry units and special operations units, especially in the Marine Corps, the Army, and the Navy.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got George on the line in Manitowoc. George, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, George.
Doing? Well, I'm a former Coast Guardsman, and I'm also the former president of the student veterans of Lakeshore Technical College, and I joined the military back in 1978, and the Coast Guard fully integrated in 1983 as far as women went, and I was stationed on a 378-foot Coast Guard cutter when we went from being 175 men, and we switched over to one-third of the crew being women. And so I was part of that integration process. And that was even before the Navy put women on ships. And we had that discussion way back then. And one of the parts of the topic came up is if women want equal rights in society, not just in the military, they need to be doing this, because it's really not fair to the men that they have these restrictions. If you don't sign up for selective service, that suddenly you're not eligible, but women still are. That was one issue. But on a larger issue is that not all jobs require great strength, upper body strength, and small stature and size can actually be a advantage.
I gotcha, George. A lot there to talk about. Thank you for sharing your experience. So, Philip, that equity issue, first of all, equal rights should equal responsibilities, he's saying, and that's one of the arguments for everybody signing up for selective service, I guess.
Yeah, the caller makes an excellent point. And one reason the Supreme Court in past held up the ban in law on women registering for selective service was because of the military's ban on combat jobs. And given that women historically could not serve in combat, they were at a great disadvantage for promotion and selection inside the military. But with that barrier now lifted, that argument for barring them, at least in terms of those previous Supreme Court rulings, is now gone. And I think it's absolutely true in not only the U.S., but international militaries that women have succeeded because a lot of these military jobs are not, you know, lifting up artillery shells or trying to carry a buddy on the battlefield. Clearly, those are significant, but a lot of it involves, for example, repairing jet engines or working in an operations center where you have to fuse intelligence and doing things like that. So for listeners out there thinking of the modern military, there definitely are a lot of opportunities that do not require the classic things you might remember from World War II movies or Korea movies.
Going to continue our conversation with Philip Ewing, National Security Editor for NPR, looking at women in the military, the idea of extending selective service in the military. We'll pick that up in just a moment.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Now that all combat jobs are open to women, do you think that women should also have to register for selective service? And if you think that women are physically capable, but you still don't support the idea of them being drafted, tell us why. If you've got a son or a daughter, how does that influence what you think of this idea? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Philip Ewing now. He's National Security Editor for NPR, talking about proposals to require young women to register for selective service, be eligible for a draft, just like their male counterparts.
And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Now, the combat jobs are open to women. Is there any reason why women shouldn't be also subject to a possible draft? Or do you think that given how warfare has changed since our last draft during the Vietnam War, that it's time for selective service to be abolished? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also send us an email to talk@WPR.org.
Back to our callers now with Fran on the line in La Crosse. Fran, hi.
Hello. Just a comment. I think before they pursue drafting, requiring women to register for the draft, they should fully ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. We've been waiting for that for how many years?
Fran, thanks for that call. Philip, basically the flip side of the previous caller there in some ways. He's saying, and if you want equal rights, you have equal responsibilities. He's saying, well, we don't have equal rights, so we shouldn't take on this responsibility. Just what are the political angles on this discussion?
It's another great point that she makes, and this is why, despite the discussions that have been raised by the Pentagon's decision to open these combat jobs to women, we may not see any actual action by Congress because of the implications for something like this. The ERA was a big controversy for a long time, and I think there would be a lot of members who say, okay, fine, if you want to have a vote on this issue, we need to take that one back up again. And I don't know that many lawmakers, especially in the Republican-controlled Congress, would necessarily be eager to do that. You know, Congress sometimes debates these issues and has long drawn out controversies and just doesn't take any action. You know, it ultimately never voted on President Barack Obama's request for military action against Syria and some of the other things that he's sent over to the Hill. So this is a kind of situation where if you're a politician, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can have these discussions, you can sponsor legislation, but you may not actually have to bear the responsibility for taking what could be a difficult vote down the line.
Fran, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Martin in Duluth. Martin, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick background. I'm 66 years old. I got pulled into the draft in the Marine Corps in the 60s. Yes, women should be included in the draft because if you don't have any skin in the game, the women and as a citizens won't get involved in foreign policy and conflicts. Having said that, the second thing I want to say is that the draft system has always been corrupted, always preys on the poor, more so on the poor, and people who are vulnerable. I mean, the people who have power and money or have a deferment of any kind can stay out of the draft. And I'd like to have you comment on those two things.
Martin, thanks for that call. And Philip, he basically brought up a big argument for and a big argument against the draft. Let's start with his second point, that the draft, he says, was unfair. Is that still the perception of how it worked back when we had it?
That's definitely still the perception among many Americans. The polls that have been taken on this since the invasion of Iraq in 2003 have found anywhere from 80% to 85% opposition to it. And I think there is a very deep and bitter for a lot of people popular memory of various deferments. This is something that has come up in the political lives of our leaders since then. Dick Cheney, Donald Trump, and others have had to deal with questions about their service or lack of service in the Vietnam context. The Selective Service System, the agency that runs the draft, says that changes that have been made since then would make it a lot more equitable than in those days, and that ways people got out of serving, if you want to look at it that way, would not be the case. Again, that's all theoretical because until there were a crisis, until Congress did pass a law requiring us to use it again, it would only be in that case that we could finally demonstrate and test how much fairer it came to be, even if women were required to sign up the way men are.
And then he brought up that skin in the game argument, and I've seen some liberal Democrats say we should have a draft because people are too disconnected from military service, from foreign policy. They don't consider the implications of an aggressive foreign policy.
That's been the complaint of a lot of people, including the Pentagon's own leaders. The former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, now retired, used to make this case a lot where he said it's too easy for people disconnected with the nature of service, with sending young men and women overseas to Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and elsewhere, to make those kinds of decisions cavalierly if they know there's no chance they or their children will be called upon to serve as part of that effort. The case you could make if you support selective service and support requiring women to be a part of it is Americans will pause before they support members of Congress or other politicians who advocate those kinds of policies, given the implications for their own lives or the lives of their families.
Martin, thanks for that call. We're talking to Philip Ewing, National Security Editor for NPR, about women in the military, the idea of having women sign up for selective service. That's been floated by some military leaders. Remains hypothetical at this point. Back to our callers now with Linda in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my question is, if women are to be drafted, how is military sexual assault going to factor into that? Just the fact that the cases are so incredibly high against women, I kind of see that as harm's way times two.
Linda?
And I'll take,
Oh, thank you, Linda, for that call. And, Philip, this an issue even without selective service, obviously the concern about sexual assault in the military.
It's a huge problem, and it's been something the Pentagon has really struggled to get control of, especially after a couple of high-profile scandals within the military, really embarrassed it in the eyes of Congress. And there's a group of very vocal women, especially in the Senate, who have been really cracking down on the Pentagon to try to get control of this. In the theoretical world in which women have to register for a draft and then enter the service that way if there were a crisis, this would be a huge problem because the military has just not found very much success year over year getting control of this problem. The reporting continues to show high levels or increased levels of the sexual assault problem. Generals and top defense officials say, well, that shows that people have more trust that we'll be able to handle their cases. That's why they continue to come forward in these high numbers. But there's no getting around the fact that this has been a big problem for the military and one that it continues to struggle with.
All right, I think we have time for one more caller. Becky in, I think it's Orfordville. Becky, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling. I have previously myself served in the United States Navy, very proud of that fact. And I have three daughters who maybe someday will also serve in the military and follow in their mother's footsteps. And I do support the draft.
And would you encourage your daughters to serve draft or no draft?
Absolutely. I'm not going to push them towards it if it's something that they don't necessarily want to do, but we come from a long line of family members who have, you know, taken up arms when needed to serve the country, and I'm raising them in a way that they're no different than any other male, and because their mom has served, they find a pride in, you know, what I did. They're very proud of the fact that their mom served, and I don't see that they would not.
Becky,
go ahead and do that.
Thank you so much for that call. And Philip, let's wrap up on a point she raises. Some people have said, hey, having women sign up for selective service will help recruit women. It'll put the idea in women's minds that men already get, they already get that job, they already have to sign up, that, hey, the military is an option for you. You can work toward that.
That is something that the Pentagon would definitely like more women to take away. They're half or more of the general population in this country, but right now they only make up about 15% of the military force. And so anything the DOD and the military services could do to get more of them, I think they're going to try.
Philip, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's NPR National Security Editor Philip Ewing. We've been talking about proposals to require women to register with selective service now that military combat jobs are open to women.